From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talk with Lynn Harrell, one of today's leading cellists. Also today, I speak with John Kelleher, who co-wrote and produced the new Irish film Eat the Peach. It's the story of two out-of-work men who become daredevil motorcyclists and small-time smugglers. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews the new edition of the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. And guest TV critic Pat Ofterheide previews two PBS specials about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is cellist Lynn Harrell. He was raised in Dallas and grew up in a home where music was the first language. His father was Metropolitan Opera baritone Mac Harrell. His mother, Marjorie Fulton, was a violinist. Harrell made his orchestral debut while in his mid-teens and was appointed principal cellist for the Cleveland Orchestra under the baton of George Zell at age 21. He's still the youngest principal in the history of that orchestra. In 1970, Harrell left the Cleveland Orchestra to begin a solo career. Since then, he's appeared with almost every major orchestra in the world, maintaining a touring schedule that takes him to approximately 115 halls a year. His work with performers like the pianist Murray Pariah and Emmanuel Ax seems to bring out Harrell's genial and hearty approach to playing and has earned him the acclaim of his peers. In 1975, Harrell and Pariah were co-recipients of the first Avery Fisher Prize, awarded on the basis of balloting of fellow musicians. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we actually talk, I'd like to show off some of your playing. What I want to do is play the opening of the Shostakovich Cello Concerto No. 1, Opus 107. We're going to hear Bernard Haitink conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra. And this is the opening of the first movement. My guest, Lynn Harrell, the cello soloist on that recording of the Shostakovich Cello Concerto No. 1, Opus 107, with Bernard Haitink conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Is that as exhilarating to play as it is to listen to?
Oh, indeed it is. I think there's kind of cold, clammy excitement and quivering intensity is the main thing that I'm feeling when I start to play that. It's almost impossible to control the explosive quality of the rhythm and the vitality required enough to actually keep it in wraps enough for it to be a public performance. I find this piece so granite and focused and powerful that it's dwarfing to come in contact with it. And at the beginning of the music sounds perhaps a little bit gay, a little bit just bouncy, but those sudden crescendos, the timpani claps, the offbeat da 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 da, just slowly scratches at you until it's just at the breaking point. It's very exciting.
Are you thinking technique, or are you just thinking what you're feeling when you're playing that?
I'm thinking technique occasionally when it gets very difficult, but mostly I'm just reacting to the emotional picture of the music.
You are, I think, one of the few soloists who actually started with an orchestral career. You started your career with the Cleveland Orchestra. Did you want to eventually become a soloist?
I think so, when I was very young. But I recognized that before my generation, it was often the case that a cello soloist, not so violin or piano, of course, that they became solo cellists after being in orchestra. It's a kind of part of their training to be part of an ensemble, because the cello is sometimes the leading soprano voice of the piece that you're playing, but sometimes it's just the bass line, the foundation, or even an inner voice. So you have to know more than, I think, a violinist or a pianist, that you're just one you're just one spoke in the wheel at times.
You have to be pretty self-effacing.
Yes.
How did you like that?
It fit with my character fine. Now, I think perhaps studying an instrument changes the character, because you have to study a musical instrument very seriously into your puberty years, even before. So the music that you play, the sound of the instrument, the size, the qualities of it, what it feels like physically to play, I think has an effect on the personality development of the person who spends all those hours alone in the practice room with the highly emotional world of making music and feeling emotional about it themselves. Something's bound to happen.
Do you think cello affected your personality?
Absolutely.
How so?
I think the cello is an instrument, as I say, that has to adjust and be part of the group more than some of the other instruments. And I'm a very much more easygoing character in certain respects. Other times, I feel I want to be the leader. I want to be the soloist and the dominating factor within an ensemble. But I have a lot of flexibility in that, just because I think of the cello.
Did you choose to start your career in an orchestra so that you'd learn ensemble playing better? You'd learn to be part of a larger group?
Yes. My teacher at that time, Leonard Rose, a great American cellist, played in years in orchestra, and he thought it was a wonderful musical training. Also, I had recently been orphaned, and I needed to have some financial security. And it was it just came along at the right time in my musical development as well.
Your father died, I believe, when you were 16, and your mother died in an auto accident 3 years after that. Was the orchestra like a surrogate family for you?
Oh, yes, yes. I was so much younger than my other colleagues in the orchestra. And in a way, I was very lonely, because I couldn't really relate to them one-on-one, because they were all as old as my parents. And their children were too young for me. And the schedule of the orchestra was very demanding. So although there was a university in Cleveland, I didn't really have time to get involved with people my own age at the time. So it was a difficult time, but one that I wouldn't trade at all, because that's the foundation of my musical and intellectual beginning.
You left the Cleveland Orchestra, I believe, shortly after George Zell passed away. Was that why you left the orchestra?
Yes, I wanted to do more solo playing. And I felt I had accomplished becoming a good principal player of an orchestra. And I just knew that it was impossible to coordinate two schedules, one of traveling around and playing as a soloist and one as being the responsible leader of a section of a great symphony orchestra. So it was one or the other. I thought at that time that maybe I'd go back into orchestra. But then when I started playing the solo repertoire, which I hadn't played for a good 10 years, I realized that there's where my heart lay, and I loved playing that solo music. And I loved being out there in front of the stage and being a soloist.
Your parents were both musicians, and as you had mentioned, they both died when you were a teenager. Most musicians, especially when they're young, I think, really immerse themselves so totally in music and shut out a lot of other parts of life. And I was wondering if you went through that even more so because of the tragedies in your own family, because you were probably forced to be more of a loner than you might have even chosen to be.
Yes, that's definitely true. I did do that, and it sometimes causes problems of adjustment for me today, because that world of myself, the hotel room, the cello, and maybe room service, can be a very complete one when I'm on tour and away from my family and away from my friends. And it's only over a protracted long period of time do I realize that that I'm not really happy living that way anymore. But certainly for a number of years, it was a kind of cocoon that was a protection against the harshness of the outside world. And in that way, music was like a savior to me. It really was a balm on hurt minds.
Your father was a Metropolitan Opera baritone. Your mother was a violinist. When you decided to start playing music, was there pressure on you to be great and to really shine?
No, there wasn't. In fact, my parents were so afraid that they would innuendo that kind of pressure that they didn't take any kind of active interest or concern with my music at all. And in school orchestras and music organizations, they'd always say, well, of course, Lin has the great advantage of his parents. But I didn't have one musical discussion with either one of them. Never went to my father's or mother's concerts. It was as though the only thing that did rub off was that music as a way of life, as a just a normal thing to do, was part of my family upbringing. Putting on a tie, practicing your instrument, warming up, putting a full dress on or a dress and going out on stage and performing in front of people was the way people lived as far as I was concerned. And it was very dramatic when I went to Florida on a vacation and I saw Chris Everett practicing tennis with her father. And I realized that her upbringing in tennis was the same sort of thing that I had in music. Just a way of life, not just something you choose as a profession.
Because your father recorded, you've been able to go back and hear him sing as a mature adult. You've been able to use your developed ears now to listen to him. Does he sound different than you remember him sounding when you were young?
No, not at all. It's overpowering to me emotionally, particularly when I am using a recording of my father's as a demonstration of something in a master class in my teaching. It's all I can do to control not just breaking up and weeping out of my misery of missing him and his art. On the other hand, I realize now more because I am a father, that he wasn't such a good daddy in certain respects. So it sort of balances out. It's very interesting.
Well, in that respect, you're probably trying to make up for that or use that as a guide for what you should or shouldn't be doing as a father, because now you're the father musician. You have twins, I think.
Yes, they're 6 years old, and they've started studying an instrument, piano and violin. And I want them to be open to the beauty and the extraordinary world that music brings, and all music, I think, brings something new to the human experience. But not so that they feel pressured that they're going to have to succeed on a certain high professional level. That would be unfortunate to have them under that kind of pressure. Some children like that kind of pressure, adjust to it, and are fine, but I don't want to take the chance.
You once said in an interview that you were kind of sorry in a way that your mother had to sacrifice her career to have children. And now that you're a parent, I wonder if you still feel that way.
No. No, I don't. Obviously, it was an ambivalence in her. I remember it being an ambivalence because she wanted to have more of a solo activity and wanted to do more playing. And she was hampered and had to look after my brother and sister and myself. But that was what she chose. It, of course, was a completely different time. The women's movement wasn't even a glint in the eye. So it was it's a different generation. But I think she could have enjoyed her life more if she had the sense that she could, like contemporary women do now, have people look after the children while she did more of the professional thing that she wanted to do.
My guest is cellist Lynn Harrell, and we'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I want to play an excerpt of your recent recording of the Bach cello suites. And I'm wondering if learning to play this is a rite of passage for cellists.
Oh, I think one would have to say so. In Casals, the great old Spanish master who died just in the mid-70s, he really was the Paganini of the cello. He was the first one in the turn of the 19th century to start to play the instrument so much better. He sort of discovered the cello suites as something more than just technical practices, and they are profound pieces of music. They aren't the St. Matthew Passion. They're not as good, I don't think, even as the Brandenburg Concerti, but they're astounding still. When you're working with a genius like Bach or, a Michelangelo etching, it's pretty astounding. It's not the Sistine Chapel, okay, but it's quite amazing. So that's what these suites are like. For the cellist, it is a real passage to go through to develop one's style and to come up face-to-face with such masterpieces. And they require so much technically, musically, aesthetically, and in every way that it's a marvelous challenge.
Let's give a listen to your performance of the Gigue from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G major.
Mm-hmm.
My guest, Lynn Harrell, performing the Gigue from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G major. I really have to say, it's a beautiful performance, and I think of the cello as having just a very emotionally direct sound, maybe more so than most instruments, and I don't know if that sounds silly or not.
No, it's perceptive of you, I think, because the cello is the only string instrument that plays really in the speaking and vocal singing registers of all four voices, bass, baritone, mezzo-soprano, and soprano. Even the highest notes of the coloratura we can play on the cello, and we often are required to by the great romantic composers. But so there's that immediacy out of identification to being human that it has, that some of the other instruments, the clarinet doesn't vibrate. The natural human voice does, sometimes quivers if it's very emotionally distraught. The oboe has a reed, and you can hear that it plays with vocal characteristics, but that it's a little bit arbitrary. I hate to say that about that instrument that I love so much. Piano, of course, is slightly a percussive instrument. When I start talking about all these other instruments, it sounds like I don't think any of them are any good. I love them all.
Obviously, but you really love cello.
I really love the cello for those direct qualities of communication that you mentioned.
Do you think the fact that your father was a singer attracted you to an instrument that has such a vocal range to it?
I think so, in a very profound way, because I don't really remember him singing in my conscious mind. But I think just the directness of the communication of the human voice is the first thing we use. It's the first thing we cry out when we're born. It's the thing we use. So the cello is, in its nature, is very, very akin to that. And the music has been written for it, the best music, takes that in consideration.
Do you have to be cautious in a way to not exploit the emotional quality of the instrument, to not be too schmaltzy, because there is, I think, that possibility with an instrument that is so emotionally charged.
Oh, yes. You have to do that very carefully in classic and Baroque music, where part of the eloquence of the communication is the fact that everything is prim and proper and the white wig is all in place, but the tears might be overflowing from the eye lids, but the fact that they can't rip the shirt open and scream and stab oneself, undress, or do any of those late romantic idealized activities, the fact that things are more in check is very much adds to the eloquence, I think.
What do you feel physically when you play? Does your body vibrate along with the cello?
A little bit. Yes, particularly the lower notes. I hold the top of the instrument against my neck as a sort of a contact point, balanced with with the other edge of the other side of the cello, with holding it with the knees. So a lot of the vibrations of the instrument flow into my neck and spine and chest, and particularly when you're playing very forcefully the lower tones of the instrument. Your vision sometimes is slightly blurred because you're quivering right along with the vibrations of the instrument. This, of course, has a very strange effect on the development of character.
That's what you were talking about earlier. Now I understand.
Yes, right.
I know a lot of musicians have this ideal sound in their head that they're always striving for, and they always feel they never reach except for on that rare occasion. Do you have such an ideal in your head? And if you do you think you could describe it?
Well, it would be embarrassing if I said, no. Yes, I think I do. But that sound is not just the cello sound. It's the nature of the cello sonority, the instrument that I've chosen, but with all the breadth and depth and meaningfulness of the very greatest orators or singers. If you listen to John Gielgud or Ralph Richardson, you just have an idea that certain words can just be so pregnant with meaning. And with an instrument that has four strings and you rub it with some horse hair with some rosin on it, it's just so diluted. So that's basically what I have in my head, and that's why it feels like it's always totally inadequate when it comes out.
What do you do when you're not getting the sound you want? Every, I think, instrument has its own set of neuroses associated with it. What do you do when you feel like, this isn't working, I have to make a change?
Yes. Yes, I recently got a Stradivari, one of the very great instruments of all time, made in 1673. And there are now times when I think, this instrument's terrible, because I've gotten used to it and I've gotten closer to wanting to make it sound a certain way. Fidget, fuss. It's all in the mind, and I try to sometimes recognize that. I remember recording and saying to the recording producer, let's listen to this tape a little bit longer because I've just started to practice something in this part of the session and I want to see what it sounds like. And I listened, and here I was playing a passage over and over again, and each time, as far as I could hear from the microphones and from the tape, was perfect. And yet I was struggling back and forth over and over again, sort of aggravatingly knocking my head against the wall. Why? Where was I? It's very symbiotic, kind of weird relationship that goes on there.
I was reading a piece about you written by your wife, who's a journalist named Linda Blandford. And she was saying that you live in constant fear of getting a cold because you don't like to have a cold when you're performing. But on the other hand, you're really careless about your hands and that you change flat tires and do hammering around the house and it drives her crazy.
Yes.
So you don't worry about your hands?
No. No, the moment I start really trying to be concerned about my hands or that part of my body that I'm just going to need to play, something goes wrong. You know, it's so like if you borrow a friend's Rolls Royce, you suddenly are so terribly nervous driving on the street, you're much more likely to have an accident.
One other thing, there's a small group of really brilliant cellists performing now. You are among them. And I wonder if you see yourselves as friends or competitors. You're sometimes recording the same parts of the repertoire. The repertoire isn't that vast. So is there this competitive edge to your relationship?
I think so. I think that's just in the nature of it. We probably think that each of us is better than the other. But on the other hand, we recognize that we're just different. And it's wonderful that in music, in art, you can't say that Rembrandt was a greater painter than Vermeer or Goya. They're just different. Velasquez, they're just different. And we try to remember that. But it's sometimes difficult. It's sometimes easy to just think that so-and-so is a wonderful cellist, but I can do this that he can't do. Not to really be truthful with oneself that artist is able to do some things that I'm not able to do. And those truths are sometimes difficult to live up to and to recognize and to try to do something about them. That slight competitiveness is a very healthy one, I think. It's caused cello playing in the last generation to advance an incredible amount. In relation to the violin as a solo instrument, the cello has had only since, let's say, 1950, the most outstanding technical accomplished virtuosos on the instrument, while the violin has had them since the late 19th century. So that's because we've all heard each other on record and broadcasts and whatnot, and we have said, oh my gosh, that's pretty good. I better go back and practice. It's healthy.
Lynn Harrell, I love your playing, and I thank you very much for being with us today.
A great delight. Thank you.
My guest has been Lynn Harrell, one of today's leading cellists. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with composer, musician, and record producer Todd Rundgren, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Irish film producer John Kelleher talks about his country's fledgling movie industry and his new film, Eat the Peach, which is opening in American theaters. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis reviews the new edition of the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. It's a 7-record set featuring performers from Jelly Roll Morton to the World Saxophone Quartet. And TV critic Pat Ofterheide previews Hellfire, A Journey from Hiroshima, and Remembering the Bomb, two documentaries airing on public television this week, the 42nd anniversary of the atomic bombing of Japan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. After more than 240 hours of testimony, the congressional hearings on the Iran-Contra affair came to a close today. Senate Republican Vice Chairman Warren Rudman said he believed he was speaking for all Republicans when he called the scandal, quote, an act of folly. Senate Chairman Democrat Daniel Inouye said the investigation showed that members of the administration had set up a shadow government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of the national interest.
It is an elitist vision of government that trusts no one, not the people, not the Congress, and not the cabinet. It is a vision of a government operated by persons convinced they have a monopoly on truth.
The White House says President Reagan plans to respond to the congressional hearings in a nationally broadcast speech sometime next week. A bomb exploded at the Saudi Arabian Cultural Center in West Beirut, Lebanon today. Police say 10 civilians were killed in the blast, and they say casualties may have been higher had the center been open at the time. They estimate the bomb contained 20 pounds of explosives. It was the second bomb attack in 24 hours on a Saudi facility in the Lebanese capital. Iran has threatened to retaliate against Saudi Arabia for the deaths of hundreds of Iranian pilgrims during clashes with police in Mecca on Friday. The Ayatollah Khomeini also is crying out for revenge against the United States, saying Washington is responsible for the deaths of the pilgrims. The skirmishes broke out when the pilgrims defied a Saudi Arabian ban on political demonstrations during the Muslim pilgrimage. And in Washington today, State Department spokesman Charles Redman denied Iranian charges of U.S. involvement in the deaths.
Iran's false charges are designed to inflame passions and escalate tensions in support of Iran's political aims to destabilize the region.
Redman also accused the Iranians of escalating tensions by warning international shipping out of the Strait of Hormuz today. The Iranians say they are staging maneuvers in the area under the codename Martyrdom. Despite the Iranian warnings, a reflagged tanker, the Gas Prince, made it safely out of the strait today under U.S. Navy escort. The Defense Department is further upgrading U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf. Up to a half dozen Vietnam-era minesweepers are being sent in to help keep the shipping lanes clear. Doctors say they're pleased with President Reagan's recovery from cancer surgery on Friday. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Mr. Reagan was back at work as usual this morning after last Friday's surgery to remove a third case of skin cancer from his nose. The president had spent a quiet weekend at the White House, and when his doctors checked him over here last night, they said they're satisfied with his recovery so far. Mr. Reagan himself pointed to his bandage and some discoloration under his eyes as he made a speech today.
I know you're all admiring my suntan. You two can look like this, just sit out in the sun. As long as I did.
Mr. Reagan's spokesman says his schedule for the week is unaffected by the surgery and that his stitches should be out in a few days. Bill Small at the White House.
Presidential envoy John Vesey has wrapped up his talks with Vietnamese leaders on missing U.S. servicemen. Both sides issued a brief statement saying the talks should speed the search for those missing in action, but they refused to answer questions or give details. Vesey boarded a special presidential jet back to the United States, where he'll brief President Reagan on the results of the talks. South Korea's ruling party and its opposition today exchanged proposals for reforms, paving the way for the country's first free election in more than a decade and a half. But the differences remain great, especially those relating to the role of the military in government. 200,000 South African miners are prepared to walk off the job on Sunday in a strike which could close down half of the country's gold mines and one-fifth of its coal mines. The miners are demanding a 30% wage increase for black miners. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 14 points to close at 25.37. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of the new edition of the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. It's a 7-record survey of jazz history, from ragtime to free improvisation.
The Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, which was first released in 1973, was criticism you could tap your foot to. It was a 6-record survey of jazz evolution compiled by Martin Williams, the jazz critic whom others in the same field most admire. Understandably, Williams concentrated on the major figures, and if his reckoning of who they were differed slightly from consensus, that was part of the fun. Williams shares certain traits with Pauline Kael, the film critic comparable to him in stature. Like Kael, he has massive blind spots. Just as she has little use for John Ford or Alfred Hitchcock, Williams has never warmed to John Coltrane, whom he severely underrepresented on classic jazz. Still, this was one of those instances in which wrong was right. Williams correctly perceived that Coltrane's imitators were leading jazz astray with their know-nothing mysticism, droning modality, and opportunistic black cultural nationalism. Besides, Williams's resistance to Coltrane illustrated his immunity to received opinion. This gave the collection a unity that no anthology chosen by committee could have matched. Now there's a revised edition of classic jazz with 7 records instead of 6. Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, Jelly Roll Morton, Thelonious Monk, Ornette Coleman, and the Count Basie Orchestra with Lester Young still dominate the collection, as well they should. With masterpieces like Morton's Dead Man's Blues, Ellington's Coco, Basie's Taxi War Dance, Monk's Mysterioso, and Coleman's Lonely Woman among the options, the problem is deciding which track to play. I've fallen back on an old rule of thumb: you can't go wrong with Louis Armstrong. This is Armstrong playing and singing Harold Arlen's I Got a Right to Sing the Blues, recorded in 1933. In the 120-page booklet that accompanies classic jazz, Williams hails Armstrong's solo as one of his most eloquent transformations of a popular song.
I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I got a right to hang around down among the rim world. A certain gal in this old town keeps dragging my poor heart around. Babe, all I'm seeing from me in misery. Oh, I got a right to moan and sigh. Got a right to sit and cry down among the river. Oh, babe, I know the deep blue sea will soon be calling me. It must be love, say what you choose. I got a right to sing the blues.
Louis Armstrong, I Gotta Right to Sing the Blues, from the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. On its own terms, the revised edition of classic jazz is just about perfect, but that doesn't mean I can't find fault with it. What disturbs me is the scant notice Martin Williams pays the last 15 years, roughly one-fifth of jazz history, after all, and the period most in need of explication. Of the 21 tracks not on the original edition, only two were recorded since 1973, Sarah Vaughan's My Funny Valentine and the World Saxophone Quartet's Steppen. Wittingly or not, classic jazz confirms the erroneous prejudice that jazz has reached the condition of epilogue, that everything new sounds like something we've heard before or something so aberrant it's not worth hearing. Williams is too vigilant an observer to believe this, but despite his advocacy of the World Saxophone Quartet, he seems basically uninterested in contemporary developments. This troubles me because if time has caught up with the most perceptive and open-minded critic ever to write about jazz, what hope does the future hold for the rest of us? Am I saying that Williams was wrong to tamper with classic jazz? Hardly. The revised edition may be an addendum rather than an update, but its programming is superior to the original, and not the least of its virtues is its ability to provoke argument while delivering epiphany after epiphany. The same could be said of Williams's commentary. Finally, all you really need to know is whether the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz is worth mailing away for. The answer is yes. Just don't accept it as the last word.
Our jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed the new edition of the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Irish film producer John Kelleher. His new film is called Eat the Peach. He co-wrote it with Peter Ormerod, the film's director. It's a low-budget film made in a country that has practically no film industry. The movie caught the attention of American film director Jonathan Demme, who brought it to America. Eat the Peach is set in the area of a vast industrial bog where two unemployed factory workers dream up an unlikely scheme to make money. Their inspiration comes from the Elvis Presley film Roustabout, in which a carnival motorcyclist rides a wall of death. They decide to build their own wall of death. Their structure is a huge wooden cylinder about two stories high. The trick is to circle around the inside base of the cylinder's wall at a high enough speed so you can spiral up the wall until you're riding parallel to the ground, held onto the wall by centrifugal force. Their ultimate dream is to take their wall of death on tour to carnivals.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Sean, Mr. Minister. And now, Vinny will demonstrate the basic technique with both hands upon the bar and afterwards with one hand upon the bar.
Please, no movement, because any sudden movement could distract the rider.
Thank you.
I asked John Kelleher if the actors and the crew were ever tempted to try riding the film's wall of death.
The fact of the matter is that we couldn't keep them away from it. It became frightening because of our insurance problems. But certainly the lead actors, they wanted to do their own stunts, which we emphatically wouldn't let them do. But even when we finished shooting each day, we had to lock it up. We had to lock the wall and keep them, you know, away, because they wanted to go in there and do it. Not just the actors, but technicians and everybody. I had no such temptation.
Why do they want to do it so much? It seems so dangerous to me.
It's probably not as dangerous as it looks. You can't get up on the wall unless you're going at a certain speed. And if you're going at that speed, you're safe.
Can you describe for us how your co-writer, Peter Ormerod, first discovered the wall of death and the story that the movie's based on?
Peter was working for Irish Network TV, and his job was to go around the country looking for interesting items that would become part of a magazine, evening magazine program. And he was driving through a fairly remote part of the Midlands of Ireland when he saw this extraordinary structure sticking up out of the very flat landscape. Went to investigate, and inside there were two guys riding motorbikes inside the wall, not on the floor, not on the ground, but inside the wall. In other words, at right angles to the ground. So he was mesmerized by this. It seemed so strange. And he started talking to them, and it emerged that they had seen an Elvis Presley movie called Roustabout, in which Elvis plays a carnival hand, and he rode this thing, which is called, Peter discovered, a wall of death. And these guys decided that they would emulate Elvis, and they had built their own wall of death with a sort of a commercial motive in mind, that they would tour it around or that people would come and pay to see, which was a fairly off-the-wall idea.
So Peter Ormerod, who co-wrote the movie with you, approached you with the idea of making a movie based on the lives of these people who built the Wall of Death and rode their motorcycles in it. What spoke to you about that idea? You don't strike me as a biker yourself or someone who'd go for daredevilry.
Well, I've ridden a motorbike. but no, it wasn't so much to do with the bikes as the idea behind what they were doing. It really appealed to me that here were two guys who were very, in a sense, ordinary people. They didn't have any education, much education. They didn't have any great deal of money or anything going for them. But they did an extraordinary thing, which was quite an extraordinary thing to do. And it was the sense of that which attracted us to it, that they didn't think it was extraordinary. They were living in an area where jobs were very scarce, where opportunities were extremely limited, and where the standard of living was not particularly high. And they channeled all of their energy and their talent and their determination into this fairly idiosyncratic event, which for them took on all the importance of a life goal. And there's something quite likable about the way in which they did it, because to them it was just a thing that they should do.
You produced Eat the Peach in Ireland, where it's set. And I can't think of a lot of films that have come out of Ireland recently. Is there much of a film industry there?
There's a great cinema-going tradition in Ireland, always has been from, the very beginning. But there has never really been a vibrant cinema industry. And this is a factor of the size, mainly, I think, of the country. The population is only 3.5 million. And without major government support, it would be unrealistic to have an indigenous Irish film industry. So what you've had has been a mixture of a number of things, American or British or other producers coming in and using Ireland basically as a location, or alternatively, indigenous Irish producers dealing with themes which they have wanted to explore and dealing with them well and validly, but often against the odds, making the movies on 16mm, or maybe they're not even full-length pictures, it might be like a 1 hour or whatever, or making them for TV or for very limited distribution.
So it must be hard finding backers in a country where there aren't many indigenous films.
Well, it's very hard, and we went about it in, I suppose, a fairly original way. We went straight out to the public and appealed to the public in Ireland to invest in this movie, in Eat the Peach, and in other movies and TV series that we would make. And we did this very publicly. We advertised, we promoted it, we went on TV and radio, and just like the guys in the film. And we were a little more successful than they were. We actually, in a three-week period, we raised $1.5 million, most of it from small investors.
The kind of film you've done is what's frequently called a small film or a personal film. It's not epic in any sense. There isn't a cast of thousands. There aren't fabulous locations. It's set in a small town and basically pretty barren land. And it is very personal kind of film. Is that the kind of film you'd like to continue to make? Would you, if given the choice, rather do something more sweeping and Hollywood-like?
No, I really wouldn't. I like very much the idea of personal films, of films which are made on low budgets, and for us that means maybe of the order of $3 million. I regard myself as a creative producer who's involved in every aspect of the creative side, as well as the business side. But the creative side, the casting, the writing, the selection of key people, and that's very exciting. And it's more exciting, I think, with a small movie, because you have more power, more control, and more ability to express what it is that you want the movie to reflect.
What would you like to see happen in terms of the Irish film industry?
I'd like to see it develop and grow to the point that there were indigenous Irish films being made which perhaps reflected modern Ireland, which is a very interesting place indeed and is not perhaps even remotely like many people's perceptions. I think that a lot of people, and particularly in the United States, despite the close ties with Ireland in the past, don't think of Ireland as a place which has a very urbanized population, a very young population. 50% of the Irish population is under 25 years old, a highly educated population, a country that's going through difficult times economically at the moment, and which may come through those, and hopefully will, a country where there's a lot more going on than explosions in Belfast or on the border. And I would like to see films made which reflect that modern Ireland, which reflect the preoccupations and the concerns of young people and not so young people, which are not stereotypes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Kelleher is the producer and co-writer of the new Irish film Eat the Peach. Here's Elvis Presley, whose film Roustabout inspired the Wall of Death in Eat the Peach.
Well, since my baby left, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room.
You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
We're following up on events in Saudi Arabia and Mecca and also in the Persian Gulf, where this week we expect there to be Iranian naval maneuvers not far from where U.S. warships are accompanying tankers up to Kuwait.
The public phase of the Iran-Contra hearings wrapped up today.
Yes. Defense Secretary Weinberger was the last public witness. We'll have a report on his testimony. And tomorrow we'll actually have a wrap-up on all of the public hearings. Today also, by the way, an interesting report about a man who is about to set sail across the Atlantic solo, and he is blind.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, our television critic David Bianculli is at a conference in California where he's previewing the fall season's new shows. While he's giving that his undivided attention, Pat Ofterheide joins us as guest television critic. She has a review of two documentaries that will be shown this Thursday on the 42nd anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima.
Happy anniversary, Hiroshima. That doesn't sound right, does it? The anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th is always an ambiguous event. Of course, you don't want to forget them, but couldn't we just kind of, you know, well, forget them? The anniversary poses one of the basic questions of our era. How do we even think about the unthinkable? How do we comprehend the unbearable? That's a challenge taken up on public television this Thursday. Some stations are airing a documentary called Remembering the Bomb. Others are airing one called Hellfire, A Journey from Hiroshima. Remembering the Bomb takes you to Hiroshima and Nagasaki for the huge 1985 anniversary of the bombings. We go in the company of some Americans, including peace protesters and one of the members of the 1945 bombing crew. Director Steve York steadily avoids sanctimony. In fact, the film astonishes for the way it shows you the problems the Japanese have in remembering the bomb. For instance, many of the bomb survivors prefer anonymity. They find they're often discriminated against in their own country. The documentary has a real you-are-there quality, and so it makes you ask yourself what people can and should do to remember horror without repeating it. In the documentary Hellfire, A Journey from Hiroshima, made by journalist John Junkerman and historian John Dower, we meet two Japanese artists, Iri and Toshi Maruki, who've come up with their own answer to that question. This aged couple have spent their professional lives jointly producing stark and elegant wall hangings on the most difficult subject for art, mass suffering. When you first meet the Marukis in their peaceful suburban garden studio, which has now become a museum, it's hard to understand how these people could produce, much less live around, their gigantic murals. The murals, in fine gradations of gray splashed with red, give you an intense sense of living and dying human experience. The Marukis explained to us that after the bombings, they both spent a month tending the wounded and burying the dead. They couldn't forget what they saw, and they couldn't make sense of it either. Painting their huge Hiroshima murals and then listening to viewers' reactions freed them from a paralyzing cycle of guilt, blame, and impotence. It took them beyond simple anti-Americanism. And then they went on to paint murals about Japanese war atrocities. They went to Poland to design a mural about Auschwitz. They painted the Minamata victims of mercury poisoning. Not everyone is happy with their work. The Japanese government, for instance, has declared it unsuitable for children. But that hasn't made a dent in their international reputation. And in Japan, their private museum gets 50,000 visitors a year. Political art is to art, they say, as military music is to music. You get the impression the Marukis would agree. As they work on one mural, you watch Iri Maruki's abstract style, which draws on Japanese traditions, do battle with Toshi Maruki's naturalistic and Western-derived style. The result isn't settled until the last brushstroke. By the way, their work is also available in a beautifully produced art book called The Hiroshima Murals. The Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings ushered in a new era. Remembering the bomb reminds us that we're still groping for ways to even think about it. Hellfire shows us that it's possible to reclaim human experience out of horror.
Pat Ofterheide is film critic for In These Times. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Sarah Paretsky, one of the few women writing hard-boiled detective novels featuring a woman detective. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will continue his series on the music of the Summer of Love. He'll describe how the record industry tried to market their versions of the psychedelic bands. And book critic John Leonard will review The White Tiger, Robert Stewart's new novel, a mystery set in Beijing. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KMUW, in Wichita, Kansas. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.